in the evaluation round on Friday, people were so appreciative and were very eloquent in expressing what kinds of needs this seminar had fulfilled for them and how it had nurtured them. And this was such a beautiful experience that on the emotional level, I basked in the afterglow of that for a couple of days. And that gave me a lot of energy.
Welcome to this episode of the Unconditional Teaching podcast. Unconditional Teaching is a project by Jessica Koch, Tilzi Bura, and myself, Katharina Pietsch. Together, we write articles and record interviews in which we investigate how we can create healthier relationships in learning and teaching. In this episode, we talk about a blog seminar titled Owning Your Position, Critical Argumentation Skills for Scholars of Culture that Til taught in July 2020. The concept of the class was to give students tools to transfer their knowledge of critical theory into discussions they have in their everyday life. In the second part of our conversation, Till talks in more depth about the strategies of argumentation and discussion that he and the students had worked on in the seminar. He also reflects on the question of why such a format is part of academic practice, and he talks about recuperation strategies after this very taxing week of online teaching.
So, Jessica, you asked about the strategies of argumentation and discussion that we worked on in the seminar and what we came up with in the seminar when we talked about how to stand our ground, how to own our position, how to engage with people in arguments and conflicts. And I would sort this roughly into three categories, the things that we discussed. And the first is that we discussed how we use our toolbox, how we use our tools of analysis, our theoretical terminology, our insights into how ideology work in discussions. So for one of the things that we discussed was how we draw an argument to the meta level, as we could say. So our analytical skills enable us to take a step back and see how the discussion works on a discursive level, which enables us to not be sort of immediately affected on the emotional level, but to look at it from above and see where the positions are, what the position of our interlocutor is, where our own position is. And then to expose that and to reflect that in the discussion, to make clear, okay, we have an expertise here and we can help to abstract from the immediate affective level to a more rational, more analytical level. And for example, to expose bad faith arguments, to expose the concern trolls, and but also to contextualize positions that are being made in good faith, but with a lack of historical knowledge, for example. So with our knowledge of the analytical toolbox, we can reflect back to people we argue with how their arguments actually work and why that may be problematic. And then we can argue against that, making clear our own position more eloquently than we could do if we didn't use the toolbox, if we didn't use our knowledge of critical theory. So this kind of abstraction, using our knowledge as scholars of culture, is one really important strategy that we have at our disposal. The second strategy or set of strategies revolves around empathy. And this was what many students said was really sort of a new perspective to them and a really important perspective for them. I introduced just a tiny bit of the principles and concepts of nonviolent communication as established by Marshall Rosenberg and based on humanistic psychology, basically a person-centered psychology in the tradition of Carl Rogers. And I did this to enable students to become more self-aware in situations of conflicts, especially. So to enable ourselves to engage in discussions with empathy toward the other, but also with empathy toward ourselves. And I introduced this basic four-step program of nonviolent communication, which is first you observe the situation, then you think about how it makes you feel, then you think about what needs are met or not being met in the situation, and then you make a request to your interlocutor, to the other person, so that your needs may be met better than they are now. And so, for example, if you're being insulted by a sexist joke, for example, then you observe first what's happening. So the other person is making a joke, which with certain ideological underpinnings, that's the observation part. Then you think about how does it make you feel? You are insulted and angry. Then you ask what kinds of needs are not being met to evoke that feeling. So my need for respect and decent treatment as a woman, for example, if you're the victim of the sexist joke, is not being met. And then you make a request, for example, don't be an asshole. Don't make sexist jokes, please. And simply having this sort of program to follow and the distinction between my affective reaction on the level of feelings and the underlying need that is not being met so that this reaction is evoked was extremely useful for students, but also the observation part, because this is exactly where our theoretical knowledge comes in and makes this easy for us to step back and see what's happening. That's exactly why I said, or this connects this to the first part, the abstraction part, the meta level analysis, and where our knowledge of the toolbox is really useful. But the point here is, and I emphasize that over and over again, to safeguard your personal integrity rather than to be constantly empathetic with your opponent and sort of make them feel better. It's about being aware, being more self-aware of your own boundaries, being able to step back not only from the content of a discussion, but also from the communicative level and see, okay, where are my boundaries? How does this make me feel? And why? And what exactly do I need to, for example, make me feel safe or make me more open to the other's position or make me feel more secure in my own position? Because many students in the prep assignment, in the emails they sent to me with the kind of situations that they usually engaged in, reported that they get angry and emotional really easily. And then if they argue with people who think they are superior and more secure in their ideological position, then they make this into an accusation. Oh, you're being so emotional, we're getting nowhere, basically. It's one of the easiest way of derailing any conversation to accuse the other person of being emotional. And obviously, because in our discipline, we have like 75-85% of women, this is usually something that women get to hear when they are angry about how men argue against them. So this is a gendered problem which affects many of our students, and I think this is also where the prevalence of this kind of feedback that I received about situations that students find themselves in often comes from.
Which of course also doesn't take into consideration the many academic and critical approaches that include emotional responses as part of the academic work that is being done. I'm thinking of, like, for instance, Black feminist thought, for instance, or a lot of Black feminists who say, okay, in order to do critical work, we need to do away with the distinction between logic and emotionality, because the two of them are intricately linked with one another anyway.
Yeah. And I mean, as I said before, on the first day, we also looked at certain kinds of rhetoric that can be based on logic more than on emotion, that can be based on common morals more than on logic, and so on. So there's different kinds of ways of arguments. And once you recognize that your emotionality also is a way that can invest your argumentation with power, then you can use that to support your position, and that this is a legitimate rhetorical strategy. Yeah, but also, I mean, I think what also chimed with a lot of students in that regard was that they often feel unsafe in these kinds of conversations, especially if they become heated, if there's hierarchies involved. So for instance, if you argue with your parents, there's immediately a kind of power play involved where students as the children sort of feel put under pressure when they know, well, the racist things that my dad say are not okay, but how do I tell him? How do I explain that? How do I sometimes make a scene? How do I make an argument emphatically and say, okay, I'm not okay with how this dinner table talk works in this family, and I as the child here want to be respected in my needs for respectful communication at the dinner table. And this is often not easy to communicate. So I think nonviolent communication had this kind of appeal of allowing yourself to step back sometimes. Also, when you recognize I don't feel safe here immediately, I need to think about something. So the empathy is directed at yourself. You allow yourself to think about your own position first. But it also, especially in conversation with family members, you want them to understand your position, right? These are the people that many students are living with, that they feel close to, and of course they don't want to treat them like internet trolls, which where the relationship level is not that important really. So the ability to make truthful, authentic requests to the other person, but also the ability to hear how they express their feelings, what kinds of underlying needs may not be met in the expression of their feelings, and then allowing them to make requests toward you, was also a perspective that they found really valuable, to make arguments work better on the level of the relationship. And this is something that I hadn't really thought about when I conceptualized the seminar, but of course I know from my own experience, from my own knowledge, from my own practice of communication, how powerful that can be. And so I was really happy that sort of my just very brief interlude on nonviolent communication had a huge impact on many of the students. And the third kind of strategy evolved out of our discussion of systemic aspects. So we had two entire days where we talked about systemic sexism, or rather systemic misogyny and systemic racism, and made clear how our analytical stance, again, makes it easier for us to abstract from particular or individual acts of sexism or racism to show how they are embedded in institutions and larger societal systems. And in that context, we talked a lot about how we can recognize our own privilege that we have, male privilege, white privilege, middle class privilege, any kind of privilege that comes to bear in these kinds of situations, how we can make ourselves aware of that, and how we can make others aware of their own privilege by overtly reflecting them toward the people we are engaged with, when they don't see how their own privilege informs their argumentative position. So again, it's a form of abstraction and then reflecting back to the interlocutor. I think this was, to me, this was one of the outcomes that proved to be strong in the seminar. Nonviolent communication and analysis of privilege are both strategies that reflect back a lot, that say, where you put yourself in a position to say, okay, what's happening right now is this and that, right? I see the position that you are arguing from, and this is how I would describe it. We are good at analysis. We are good at description as scholars of culture. So we can use it to make us in not different, but more similar, by using the abstract terminology to create an understanding of the situation, of the content of the discussion, where both interlocutors can agree on that this is what is happening. You can still differ on the level of content, on the level of argument, but where we can profit from our expertise is that we can always take a step back and say, okay, this is what's happening on the level of communication, this is what's happening on the level of content, and do you agree? Do you agree that this is what is happening? And then say, I want this to continue like this, and I want this, and I need this, and what do you want? What do you need? And if the argument is being met in good faith, then it's much easier to communicate once the premises on an analytical level are being made clear.
I mean, what that needs, of course, is a well of patience, really, on the part of us when we engage with this. And I totally understand that needs practice. That it's not, because it's a type of mental stance, a Haltung, as it were, as you would put it, probably, that requires a lot of practice in order to work. Because I can already see myself sitting together with people at a party and having like arguments about the gender wage gap and something like that. And I can, just thinking about it, I can feel the frustration building up in me. And to be capable of sitting there and evaluating the situation, letting your interlocutor speak, to then be able to do this kind of abstraction, I think that takes a lot of training, a lot of practice.
Yeah. And I mean, this is what we did in a smaller amount than I would have wished for, but we did these kind of role playing where people could try that out. And of course, everyone found that difficult. I find that difficult if I'm being put in situations like this where I need to sort of show how this works, even though I have so much more practice doing this. Yeah. Okay. And another thing I would like to address, which I was thinking about after the seminar, is why this is part of academic practice. So I had this knee-jerk reaction to tell myself, well, was this a self-help seminar? Or was this part of higher education? Right? Was this part of academic training? Was this part of science and scholarship? And because what made this field so good overall was that I think students found ways of expressing their political position more effectively, more personally, more consciously than they were able to do before. And of course, to transfer our theoretical knowledge to everyday life, to then make a difference in our contact with other people, to change how you think about the world, to change how others think about the world, that's an intensely political act. And as such, it is important in its own right. And this doesn't make the seminar academic as such, but it makes it political as such, which I think it's important. And I would be fine with that, basically. But I also think it doing these kinds of exercises and doing it in a classroom setting and not just on our own makes us better academics, because it shows us where experience feeds back into theory. It gives us a reason to go back to our analytical terminology and our knowledge of critical theory, and to tweak and develop the way that they frame the phenomena we engage with on an everyday level. So we learn by applying our toolbox, as I said in the beginning, in these kind of contexts. We learn about how and why they have changed over time, and we learn to change them again ourselves. And this is, I think, what work in the humanities is all about.
So it is essentially part of what we call in Germany Wissenschaftskommunikation, in a sense as well. Because chances are quite good that you're not just, you know, talking to the person who is your immediate interlocutor, but also to people who may be sitting around listening to that conversation. You know, when you're with your family at the dinner table, or when you are at parties and you meet random acquaintances who are not, you know, part of the humanities or something like that. So what you're doing is communicating something that would otherwise stay within the ivory tower outside to sometimes a non-academic public. Yeah. And that's incredibly important.
Yeah. And it also makes clear why we need the toolbox. It gives additional motivation to dig in hard and engage with the basics of theoretical thought, political thought that we deal with in our academic life all the time, on an historical level, on an activist level. One of the examples was, or one of the strongest examples for that, for me, is that we cannot understand these, the currently going on, the vicious arguments between radical feminists and trans rights activists, as encapsulated basically in the controversy around J.K. Rowling's tweets on transgender people. So these arguments that rage on Twitter also have an impact on political committee work and policies that decide on gender recognition acts or bathroom policies and so on. And we cannot understand why this is so harsh. The language is so harsh and the positions are so entrenched without understanding what second wave feminism is, as opposed to later postmodernist and post-structuralist notions of gender, which are based on a kind of radical constructivism that wasn't prominent before. And in order to understand that, to understand this history, to understand the demarcations of theory, you have to read a lot. But you have to have a reason to read a lot. So political activism is one of the reasons to engage with this kind of theory, which is long and complex.
So basically, a class like yours also gives students reasons to engage with theory and really dig deep, because only when you really understand the stuff can you translate it into convincing arguments to people who are not well versed in these things. So this basically also ties into our How to Teach Theory podcast, where we talked exactly about this. You can't really teach theory. You can't bestow the knowledge of theory on students. You have to give them reasons to engage with it and find their own ways to do something with it, to wield it, as we said, and showing them that being able to own these arguments when they are really well versed in theory is basically one of the prime examples.
Yeah, nice. We can stop here. Mic drop.
I have one more question though. How did you recuperate from this stressful experience? Because I'm still trying to figure out how to do that myself. I've been teaching online, like on and off this semester in different formats, and I can feel like my back pain coming and my head being all like, how did you recuperate and how did you reward yourself for a week of an intense teaching experience? And maybe what can other lecturers or students maybe take away from your way of recuperating? I guess cake will have been involved.
Cake and muffins were involved, indeed. Yes. I would distinguish between two things. I would distinguish between physical recuperation and emotional recuperation. And the emotional recuperation started on Wednesday afternoon when I said, I can't do it right now. I can't do this. And please take over. And people were so understanding. And I received emails that afternoon and later that evening asking whether I was any better and that this was no problem. And even an email saying, thank you for trusting us with this situation. And all the appreciation and kindness and gentleness that I received during the entire seminar, and all the appreciation that students gave to themselves also, not just to me, because at some points I was just facilitator for them sharing experience, and they reacted the same with the same gentleness and kindness to each other's experience, which involved emotional and physical abuse stories sometimes. Because if you are engaged in these intense conflicts, then you have to do with violent people, right? And sometimes this is actual violence, and people shared their stories, and we talked about that, and everyone was very accepting and kind in these situations. And in the evaluation round on Friday, people were so appreciative and were very eloquent in expressing what kinds of needs and thirsts, in a sense, this seminar had fulfilled for them, and had how it had nurtured them. And this was such a beautiful experience that on the emotional level, I basked in the afterglow of that for a couple of days. And that gave me a lot of energy and made it perfectly clear that I was right in doing this. And I mean, up until the evening before, I had told myself, oh, if only I had canceled the seminar, because this can only not work, because I don't feel prepared, because what I had wanted to do is only half possible, and all these things. And at the end, I was completely convinced that this had been the right choice, and I felt good about it. And the feedback was amazing. So the things that students took away were incredible, incredibly important for them, and incredibly gratifying for me to hear and to witness and be part of that. On the physical level, I mean, just sitting around staring into nothing does a lot for me, into empty space, listening to music. And I've been going running for the last like 6 weeks, I think, 4 times a week. And I did that with gusto after the seminars, and that gave me back energy too. So physical exertion, plus the cake. Then, yeah.
Well earned cake. Well earned. Well earned.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, recuperation strategies are individual things. They are different for different people.
That's true. But I think getting ideas is for what may be cool to try and see.
What I need is immersion into things, sort of idling, puttering about, being on my own, not socializing that much. And I did a lot of that.
I think what might also be important is one thing you did. You made sure that everyone got their Studienleistung on Friday.
Yeah.
So that you didn't have a huge aftermath to deal with that, like, draws on and on and on. And
I made it really easy for students to get their check in the system. And I made it really easy for myself to check everyone on Friday and be done with that. That was a good strategy. That was really smart, I think. Yeah. For them, that was really good. And for me, it was really good too.
Thanks for listening. Unconditional Teaching is a project by Tilsi Bura, Jessica Koch, and me, Katharina Peach. Music by Lily Olason. If you want to know more about our project and our partners, check out unconditional-teaching.com. Do you like our content or would like to engage with us? Head over to our comment sections or contact us via team@unconditional-teaching.com.